The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
All right, we're going to get started. Welcome to night one of C.S. Lewis. I am deathly ill, so you should not speak to me or touch me in any way. But I am going to teach on C.S. Lewis tonight. Quick outline for the next two nights of your life. Tonight we're gonna focus largely on Lewis's story, taking a particular interest on three or four kind of core ideas that are really central to Lewis's life, his writing, his thoughts, and that'll be tonight. We hopefully can get through all of that. Tomorrow night when we show up here, we're going to walk through his books, all of them, every single one of them. And we're going to basically track these basic ideas through those books. Owen Barfield, one of Lewis's close friends, said of Lewis that what he thought about anything was contained in everything that he wrote. And so you could find out what he thought about pretty much anything by taking any book you wanted, and you could find out what he thought about everything else in the world. So tomorrow night when we come back, we're going to finish whatever we don't get through tonight. And then from there, we'll walk through his main books. And tonight will be a lot more lecture. Tomorrow night will be a lot more interactive. So if there are books that you particularly like, that you want to talk about, be vocal and tell me. And we'll spend more time on those books tomorrow night. A little bit of my story on Lewis. And I will be sitting on a stool tonight and maybe tomorrow night. For part of the time. That'll happen probably three times in my life, so take pictures. I can't do it. I was introduced to Lewis in college through one of my professors, a professor named Sam Storms. I'd read Mere Christianity, but that was kind of basically, and Chronicles of Narnia as a kid. My grandmother got me those when I was very, very young. Read through those. And he actually introduced me to Weight of Glory, a couple of other pieces of Lewis's work that were pretty formative for me. When we moved to Denver to start the church, we're planting a church, and I thought, what a better way to spend the first 2 years of planting a church than trying to read every single thing that Lewis wrote. And so I tried to read every single thing that Lewis wrote, and it has been, I think probably one of the most important things that happened in the life of Park Church in terms of setting the trajectory for where we were going to go. We'll get into some of that tonight, just in terms of why I think Lewis is so important and why I think he's so particularly important in a city like Denver and a culture like ours. We'll get into that. But I love this man. The last 3 weeks of getting back and just kind of trying to work through as much of his books, as quickly as I could to get ready for tonight and tomorrow night. Has just been like an injection of adrenaline for my soul. So I'm excited to talk about him. Didn't really matter how sick I was. I didn't want to have to give up tonight to talk about Lewis and tomorrow night. So tonight, kind of core ideas and kind of his trajectory, his life story a bit. Tomorrow night we'll work through his books, spending more time on some, less time on others. That'll be kind of the line. This handout you should have on your table. Put this together. It is a first part is I will recommend to you. I will recommend to you. People ask all the time, "Hey, all I've ever read is Narnia, or all I've ever read is Mere Christianity. Where should I start to really get into Lewis?" I recommend 100% of the time everybody start with Surprised by Joy. We've got that book upstairs. If you don't have it, hopefully there's like 10 people who don't have it in this room. We should not have any of those left by Sunday. Surprised by Joy is the place to start. I think it's top five all-time books for me. Start with Surprised by Joy. It's his autobiography of kind of his seasoned examination of his own conversion. So 30 years after his conversion, he looks back and tells that story basically from his childhood up to his conversion. That's Surprised by Joy. You will get... you'll get what he's about in that book. In fact, I would say you'll understand and appreciate Narnia better because of that book than anything else you could read. So Surprised by Joy. Then go to Abolition of Man. Abolition of Man is work by Lewis that is one of his harder books to read. It's also talk about Lewis having one major battle his entire life. Abolition of Man is kind of him throwing down the spear in the middle of the battlefield and saying, here's where I'm going to spend my life at war. And so that's Abolition of Man. And then last, I would go to some of his lesser-known fiction. Till We Have Faces is my all-time favorite book, and I think it is beautiful. My copy of it, it's like literally the pages are nasty because I've cried so much through that book. I'm a crier. But that book is astounding and amazing and beautiful, and you'll see how really in Abolition of Man and Surprised by Joy, how kind of the culmination for him was his retelling of this old story, Until We Have Faces, in a way that's really astounding. If you're not into Till We Have Faces, I would then go to the Space Trilogy. If you're not a science fiction fan, doesn't matter. These don't read like any science fiction you've ever read in your life. I hate science fiction, and I love these three books. Starts with Alice Silent Planet, Paralandra, and then That Hideous Strength. Alan Jacobs, actually most Lewis scholars say that Hideous Strength is Lewis's best book in terms of quality, in terms of it's his greatest work. Lewis thought that Till We Have Faces, it was his favorite book. That Hideous Strength was, by most scholars, is considered his greatest work. If you can work all the way through the Space Trilogy, get to that book, you'll be floored. So that's all I got by way of introduction. One last. Got a timeline, and then I've basically taken every book, most every book that he wrote, on those last pages, and given you at least a sentence on, hey, what is this? So if you're interested in looking at other things that he's done, written, taught about, lectured on, you can kind of look through there and figure out where you want to go look him up. All right, y'all ready to get started? Good. I love C.S. Lewis, man. And I love sitting in a room, or standing most of the time, in a room full of people that want to hear about him, talk about him. And this man has had as profound an impact on my life as anybody I know. So let's pray and give thanks to God, and then we will talk about Clive. God, it is a marvelous thing. That not only do you give us your word, not only do you give us your son, but as we look back over the centuries and life of your church, I mean, you've given us men and women who, through the gifts that you've given them, through the insight and experiences you've given them, you've allowed them to be gifts to your body and your church. And so, God, we presume tonight to gather and not at all to belittle your son or your word, but God, but to be thankful for the insight that this man gives us into both. And so, God, I pray that tonight we would appreciate and give thanks to you for this man. More than that, though, God, I pray that we would learn from his insight, what I think of as his key insight, the connection between the objectivity of truth and joy. And, God, how those two things are intimately connected. God, I pray that you would cause us to see that tonight in a way that maybe we haven't, to appreciate it in a way that we haven't, that might set the course and the trajectory for our lives. So God, I pray that you come and help my voice to hold up, and may tonight bear fruit in this city, for the name of Jesus and your glory and your renown here. In your name we pray, amen. Are we good on chairs? Do we need chairs? Are we good? We have seats scattered. If you have a seat at your table, if you could raise your hand so that the people in the back can come. Everybody has a seat. So you can pick. You can take your pick. Pick whatever you want. All right. Two quick things about C.S. Lewis as we get going. First, the project of his life is what he called Mere Christianity. Mere Christianity was his attempt to basically define a common core to Christianity that would be believed by everyone everywhere who called themselves Christians. Now, there's a couple things that I need to do in by way of apology for C.S. Lewis right off the get-go as we talk about this project called Mere Christianity. First, you cannot lead a church this way. Two, you can't actually be a churched person this way. But he sat in a particular place, a particular time, with a particular voice and was able to articulate Christianity in a way to a public that helped kind of navigate through all the particularities of denominations and theology and history and all of those things that kind of gained him a hearing where nobody else had one. Now, the problem is it's there's not a single doctrine of the Christian faith that has not at some point been debated. So to set out to do Christianity this way, to articulate Christianity this way, is right there, right off the get-go, just a little bit troublesome, right? So we can't talk about the resurrection, we can't talk about the atonement, we can't talk about a whole slew of particularities around Christianity, because all of them have been debated by someone somewhere. So his project was mere Christianity, but I as a pastor don't have I don't have the option to do Christianity that way. In fact, I'm actually going to believe that C.S. Lewis actually calls me as a pastor to do Christianity quite a bit differently than he did it. But you do need to know that was the primary project of his life. He is significant in a number of different ways. One, he is still considered today by Christian and non-Christian alike one of the top medieval literature scholars ever. So his book, Allegory of Love, is still used today in the highest places of study in studying medieval literature. He is considered just a landmark scholar in his own time, and he continues to be even in our day. So quite apart from Narnia, quite apart from the things that have made him popular in Christian circles, in scholarly circles, non-Christian scholarly circles, he is a landmark scholar. He's still respected to this day. There's something to be said there about all of us who work in fields. I don't work in fields outside of the church to do the best possible work you can. His Allegory of Love, we'll talk about it a little bit next week, kind of put him on the map at Oxford, and then because it put him on the map at Oxford, put him on the map everywhere. It's going to be really distracting, so I'm going to sit down, stand up, but we'll just go with it. but his importance and his uniqueness is not just that he was a top scholar, but there's been a lot of top scholars. His breadth of writing is really astounding. In terms of cultural critique, Abolition of Man is as incisive a work critiquing modern culture as you'll find anywhere. He wrote children's fiction, he wrote adult fiction, he wrote fantasy stories, he wrote science fiction, he wrote apologetics, he wrote works of theology, he wrote works of literary history, he wrote everything imaginable. The guy covered just his breadth of knowledge and his breadth of writing in terms of what he was actually able to address in his life through his writings is altogether astounding. And when you consider, here's a guy who's writing definitive works on medieval literature, and at the same time writing children's stories that are still read today, 40, 50 years later, it should cause you to think, and it should cause us to hold up our hands and say to God, hey, will you raise up more Lewises, more men who understand, more women who understand the world, see the world, have a grasp of the world like he did, and are able to speak both to children and to the highest halls of scholarly work. He was born in 1898 in Ireland. He fought in World War I, was injured in World War I, was sent back to Oxford, and then studied at Oxford. A few kind of highlights from his childhood life. You'll get all of this in Surprised by Joy. He was a part of a number of different schools. Some of the most entertaining sections of Surprised by Joy are his times spent at what he called the Coll, or Malvern College. It was kind of where he went to, basically it would have been his junior high, early high school days, and it was it's kind of Lord of the Flies-ish. It was a terrible experience in every possible way. After studying at the Coll, his mother died, by the way, early on for him. After studying at the Coll, his father, who Lewis's take on his father, he later in life will start to, he'll say that he was too harsh towards his father. His father was a highly sentimental, illogical human being. And Lewis was not a very sentimental and very logical human being. And so they were kind of opposites. And so he kind of would thumb his nose at his dad. But there's a hilarious story in Surprised by Joy what's actually important to his larger story, in which his dad has finally agreed to pull him out of Malvern. And Lewis is thrilled. I mean, just absolutely excited. And he's going to send him to study with this teacher known as the Great Knock, and that his family called the Great Knock. And Lewis's dad would just tell him story after story after story about the Great Knock and how sentimental and warm and cozy and fuzzy a man is, the man was. And we'd always tell the story that the Knock just loved to grab you by the face and kind of rub his beard up against your face. I just had this picture. And so Lewis is, I'm actually going to read this section. One thing I'm not going to apologize for, I just want to read chunks of Lewis to you, if that's okay. The Great Knock. It's one of the greatest chapters ever. And so that's his impression of the Knock. He's not looking forward to that at all, but he's just excited to get away from Malvern and be here with this guy. And finally, so he was going to spend his last years in school with a tutor named the Old Knock. And here is his first interaction with the Knock when he gets off the train. He was over 6 feet tall, very shabbily dressed. By the way, the Knock is different characters from Lewis's past appear in his fiction. So the man, the professor from Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he is essentially the Great Knock. So you'll see that over and over again. How many of you read the Space Trilogy? Have you read the Space Trilogy? So Ransom is J.R.R. Tolkien. So that's that is an interesting little bit about, he would always include his friends in his fiction. He was over 6 feet tall, this is the Great Knock, very shabbily dressed, like a gardener, I thought, lean as a rake and immensely muscular. His wrinkled face seemed to consist entirely of muscles, so far as it was visible, for he wore mustache and side whiskers with a clean-shaven chin like the Emperor Franz Joseph. The whiskers, you will understand, concerned me very much at that moment. My cheek already tinged in anticipation. Would he begin at once? There would definitely be tears, perhaps worse things. It is one of my lifelong weaknesses that I never could endure the embrace or kiss of my own sex. An unmanly weakness, by the way. Apparently, however, the old man was holding his fire. We shook hands, and though his grip was like iron pincers, it was not lingering. A few minutes later, we were walking away from the station. You are now, said Kirk. That's the Knock's real name's Kirk. Proceeding along the principal artery between Great and Little Bookham. I stole a glance at him. Was this geographical exordium a heavy joke? Or was he trying to conceal his emotions? His face, however, showed only an inflexible gravity. I began to make conversation in the deplorable manner which I had acquired at those evening parties and indeed found increasingly necessary to use with my father. I said I was surprised at the scenery of Surrey. It was much wilder than I had expected. Stop! Shouted Kirk, with a suddenness that made me jump. What do you mean by wildness, and what grounds had you for not expecting it? I replied, I don't know what, still making conversation. As answer after answer was torn to shreds, it at last dawned upon me that he really wanted to know. He was not making conversation, nor joking, nor snubbing me. He wanted to know. I was stung in attempting a real answer. A few passes sufficed to show that I had no clear and distinct idea corresponding to the word wildness, and that insofar as I had any idea at all, wildness was a singularly inept word. Do you not see, then, concluded the Great Knock, that your remark was meaningless? That was his introduction to the Great Knock. And then here's his summary of this guy. If ever a man came near to being a purely logical entity, that man was Kirk. Born a little later, he would have been a logical positivist. The idea that human beings should exercise their vocal organs for any purpose except that of communicating or discovering truth was to him preposterous. The most casual remark was taken as a summons to disputation. I soon came to know the differing values of his three openings. And he goes on to summarize it. The Great Knock became for Lewis his tutor, not just in an academic sense, but he became for him really a mentor on how to see the world. Now Kirk was an atheist, as far as Lewis knows, remained an atheist till the day he died. But his way of seeing and asking for and demanding clear arguments, clear, real, substantive truth behind things that were being said. His zero tolerance for empty words and just meaningless talk would shape Lewis forever. And so Lewis studied with the great Nock. During his time with Nock, World War I broke out. He was accepted into Oxford before he could begin his studies at Oxford, went to the front in World War I in France, was injured there, returned, and began his studies at Oxford. Finished with honors, did incredibly well, although his joke was that he was fairly certain that they kind of waived all the pre-tests that he had to take. He was positive that he failed the math portion and would not have been accepted at Oxford, which is kind of a funny thing to think about if you think about the rest of his career at Oxford. So he began his studies at Oxford, graduated there, spent his first year teaching at Oxford as a professor of philosophy. He hated it. His descriptions and surprised by joy, what happened to his soul studying philosophy and teaching philosophy. He understood the subject matter well, but teaching it, teaching and aiming at things like truth devoid of beauty, shriveled his soul. And so what happened next was he was moved to the literature department at Oxford. That was where he met J.R.R. Tolkien. And that begins really kind of our formal outline for tonight. He describes at the end of Surprise by Joy a series of moves. He describes them almost as chess moves made by God, in which God slowly kind of cornered Lewis through a series of ideas introduced to him at Oxford, introduced to him by a handful of friends that led ultimately to his conversion. So what I want to do tonight for the rest of our time is I want to walk through those moves. What we're going to see is those moves really represent some of these core ideas I want to talk about. And the first move was his move from the philosophy department to the literature department. Seems insignificant at one level. He just moved to a different department in the college. But in reality, that move for him opened up for him a renewed journey to what he would say was the central theme of his life, which was the pursuit of joy. As you begin to walk through the course of his life, you find that he would say that his life has been about nothing other than this, to discover this thing he called joy. Now, you need to understand his conception of his definition of the word joy is different than what we mostly think of when we say the word joy. I'm going to write the word joy on the whiteboard because I feel the need to do something. And so, here we go. So joy for him is not happiness. Joy for him is not pleasure. Joy for him is not triviality and lightness. It is not a smile. Joy is defined for him as inconsolable longing. I'm going to read another quote from Lewis on what joy is. This is actually from Surprise by Joy. This is where he is attempting to define it. He says, the reader who finds the three episodes that he records before this are these experiences he had. He'll call them at other places sinsucht. He'll call them northernness. This kind of ache that he had as a boy that he couldn't put his finger on. The reader who finds these three episodes of no interest need read this book no further. For in a sense, the central story of my life is about nothing else. For those who are still disposed to proceed, I will only underline the quality common to the three experiences. It is that of an unsatisfied desire, which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. So his explanation of what joy is that it is a desire, that feeling that desire is more desirable than any satisfaction you've ever felt. Can you remember moments in your life where you've felt that? That it was an unsatisfied desire. Whatever it was that you longed for. And you most times when I've experienced this, you couldn't even articulate, that's what I want. You just have this groaning ache within you. That's what he's trying to describe here. I'll keep going because he's better at it than I am. which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. I call it joy, which is here a technical term and must be sharply distinguished both from happiness and from pleasure. Joy, in my sense, has indeed one characteristic and only one in common with them, the fact that anyone who has experienced it will want it again. Apart from that, and considered only in its quality, it might almost equally well be called a particular kind of unhappiness or grief. But then it is a kind that we want. I doubt whether anyone who has tasted it would ever, if both were in his power, exchange it for all the pleasures in the world. But then joy is never in our power, and pleasure often is. He describes his early life as constantly seeking after that experience over and over and over and over and over again. How can he get back there? He found it in the music of Wagner. He found it in the old myths. He found it in all kinds of places, but then he would get close to it, and then it would disappear. And he tried to find it with sex. He tried to find it with all kinds of other things, and he could never quite get it. But he would say that this search, what was the definitive search for his life, of his life. Now, what had happened to Lewis during his time at Oxford is that he had taken on a kind of academic objectivity, a kind of coolness, a kind of way of examining everything out there, holding it at a distance, and in doing so, it kind of put down the hounds in him that were driving him after this joy. And so he'd kind of taken on this sort of academic persona through which he could kind of keep everything at a distance and examine it at a distance. And in philosophy, in the philosophy department, it's exactly what he allowed him to do. And if you think about the nature of philosophy, this is going to come up later in one of the other insights, philosophy is all about examining things rather than experiencing them, right? So it's not so much about thinking thoughts, it's about thinking about the way you think about thoughts. So it's looking at something rather than experiencing something. And the move to literature is exactly the opposite. It's first and foremost an experience of something that after you experience it, you take a step back and then you begin to examine what you're looking at. We've got these paintings up in the room and over there. And you think about the artists when they painted them, which I should ask them. The paintings, our hope is not that they're sitting there when they're painting them, examining, here's the process by which I'm going about this. You hope that they're involved completely with the vision of the art. I'm experiencing that, and then afterwards can take a step back and go, oh, here's what I did. Does that make sense? Does that make sense at all? Artists, nod or shake your head. That was the move for him, and that was move number one. Now, it's really humorous as he's describing these moves as they take place in Surprised by Joy. He describes God as the hound of heaven. He describes God in all these terms and says, and I didn't really think this was that big of a deal. I didn't think that was a big deal. And then he gets to a certain point, he goes, and then I began to realize what was happening. And I was just a few steps away from being a theist. He did not want to be a Christian. And so to just step in there, he considered the vision, Christian vision of God as the great interferer. And he wanted nothing to do, to do with that sort of God, with that sort of being. He did not want to be interfered with. He was an introvert. He wanted to be left alone. And he did not want to be told what to do. And knowing that there was a God was a tragic, tragic move for him. The first move is a move back into a place where this longing for joy could be awakened for him. I'll keep going. I'll come back to that quote. The second move was a philosophical move for him, and it was a move to recognize a distinction I just tried to illustrate there, a distinction, but that there is a difference between the terminology uses enjoying something or contemplating something. So it's the difference between. So if I sit in a chair, I'm enjoying the chair. I'm not thinking about the chair, I'm just sitting in it. If I stand up and think about the particular engineering that went into this chair, which is remarkable, think about how light and poorly made it is, that it can actually hold all of us here and hardly anyone will fall out of it. It actually begins to contemplate the engineering that went into this chair, then I am contemplating the chair, I'm not enjoying the chair. He read in the book that he recognized that distinction, and it was a massive move for him. And if you begin to think about it, it's a pretty remarkable distinction. And this is I can't overestimate how important this distinction was for Lewis. I mean, forgetting him, and I think it's also one of the hardest things to grasp in his move. So let me spend some time trying to work on this. Here's how he would say it. He'd spent his entire life trying to pursue joy. And joy, he found, was a desire, right? It's this inconsolable longing, this inconsolable desire for something. And so he'd spent his entire life examining the thing called joy, looking at it. And he never experienced it when he looked at it. He only experienced it when he looked at something else. In other words, he would enjoy joy when he contemplated Wagner. He would enjoy joy. He would experience that desire. He'd experience that longing when he began to establish his relationship with Mrs. Moore. He would experience longing, and then here's where he found this distinction to be true throughout his life. He would experience that feeling, right? So he'd hear Wagner, be blown away by it, find that desire, that joy rising up within him, and he'd go, "That's what it is." Then he would stop focusing on Wagner, stop focusing on these myths, stop focusing on this woman, and he began to examine now the joy itself, because that was what he wanted. He wanted the feeling. And the moment he did that, every single time, it was dead. He was no longer had the feeling. He no longer felt the desire. He no longer felt the longing. And so he found, as he examined his whole life, this repeated cycle of he'd wander into the woods, if you will, experience there that experience of longing, that experience of joy, and then his mind would start freaking out. Like, this is what we want. This is what we wanted since we were a boy. Let's stop and figure it out. How did we get here? How do we feel this? How do we find and place our entire lives in this particular position so we can always feel this, always experience this, always know this? And the moment he did that, poof, gone. In other words, there was a distinction. There's always a distinction between enjoying something and contemplating something. Which, that leads to the next move, which is amazing. He said, this is where kind of everything changed for him. Is it meant that there was an object for that joy? There was something out there that was real. That was, if he found in himself this desire that could never be satisfied by anything he found, anything that he just had tasted it, he'd experienced it, he'd known echoes of it. He began to realize that if that desire is real, then it's attached to a particular object. Now, you're all looking at me like that's the most obvious thing in the world. But I would say in our day and age, and this is where we get into why I think Lewis is so incredibly important for us, that is the exact opposite of everything that our culture tells us. Joy, fulfillment, meaning, reality is in here, not out there. This move for Lewis was massive, and if you can get it, it will be massive for you. That the object of that desire is not something in here, it's out there. What follows from that is that truth is objective. It is outside of us. Reality stands outside of us, not inside of us. His whole life had been spent trying to find something in here. And every time he looked in here, it was gone. But now all of a sudden the move was, no, you don't look in here. You don't look for an experience of the heart. You don't look for a feeling in here. You look for something outside of you. That becomes the object of your desire, not the experience itself. In other words, the desire doesn't become the desire. The object is what you should desire. The object is what you find fulfillment in. The object is what you should aim your life at. If you want to experience joy, you have to align yourself with something outside of yourself. And you can see now that he's only steps away from at least theism, if not Christianity. The next step was a philosophical move, a fairly technical one. He was already Hegelian, which meant he thought that kind of at the back of reality was this absolute. He simply made a step there to say, what if the absolute is a person and has a personality? He was very, very careful during all this time to always distinguish this person, this absolute person, from any sort of religious god. He thought those were all early attempts by mankind to describe the absolute. But now, what if this absolute actually had a personality? It actually could be interacted with. It actually could do things and say things and command things. And that was a subtle shift for him. And then two things happened, which represent kind of the final move for Lewis. The first is he read a book by G.K. Chesterton called The Everlasting Man. Absolutely astounding, amazing book. he read Everlasting Man, and he said he found himself thinking, although he would have never said it, because saying it would have admitted the absolute foolishness of what he was saying, was that if it wasn't for all of that Christianity would actually make a lot of sense. This is the exact quote. That he found that Christianity, apart from it being Christianity, seemed to make a lot of sense. So he read that, found himself thinking that, and then he said kind of the fatal move for him as an atheist, and I'll read it in a second, is he's sitting in his study, and he said the most hardened atheist he'd ever known in his entire life was sitting in his office. They were smoking, and the hardened atheist, who still remains an atheist. So Lewis says, the guy's saying, I'm still an atheist, but he says, you know, it seems that this whole Christianity thing actually turns out to be true, which is funny. that whole bit about all the historical facts about Christianity, it actually appears that there was a guy named Jesus who actually lived and died and evidently came out of the grave. It's really weird. Smoked his pipe, took a drink of scotch, and left. And Lewis was sitting there going like, well, if it's, he already made these connections, right? Like joy and something outside of him, something that accords with reality, and that those two things have got to be linked. And all of a sudden, here's this atheist saying, yeah, it's true. Now, he didn't share that view with Lewis, so he can walk out and not care. But for Lewis, like, that was the story of his life. He's been looking for it all his life, and he's been resisting this over and over again. He finds his own thoughts echoing again and again and again. Well, if it wasn't Christianity, then it would actually make sense. And all of a sudden, this hardened, brilliant atheist sitting in his office says, yeah, it actually appears that it's true. And Lewis said it was just then a matter of time. Let me read the last bit, kind of his story of conversion. Now, mind you, this is not the story of his conversion to Christianity. That was far less dramatic. This is his conversion to actually admitting that there's a God. Nope. That's not it. I'm going to look it up. Here it is. Title of the chapter is Checkmate, by the way. I don't want to read too much, but I kind of want to read a lot. I now perceive this, that if Shakespeare and Hamlet could ever meet, it must be Shakespeare's doing. Hamlet could initiate nothing. Perhaps even now, my absolute spirit, this kind of idea, this absolute being that he talked about with this kind of philosophical move, still differed in some way from the God of religion. The real issue was not, or not yet, there. The real terror was that if you seriously believed in even such a God or spirit as I admitted, a wholly new situation developed. As the dry bones shook and came together in that dreadful valley of Ezekiel's, so now a philosophical theorem, cerebrally entertained, began to stir and heave and throw off its grave clothes, and stood upright and became a living presence. I was to be allowed to play at philosophy no longer. It might, as I say, still be true that my spirit differed in some way from the God of popular religion. My adversary, that's God, waived the point. It sank into utter unimportance. He would not argue about it. He only said, I am the Lord. I am that I am. I am. People who are naturally religious find difficulty in understanding the horror of such a revelation. Amiable agnostics will talk cheerfully about man's search for God. To me, as I then was, they might as well have talked about the mouse's search for the cat. The best image of my predicament, I'm going to skip that, because I don't even know what that is. That's why I skipped it. Remember, I had always wanted above all things not to be interfered with. I had wanted mad wish to call my soul my own. I had been far more anxious to avoid suffering than to achieve delight. I had always aimed at limited liabilities. The supernatural itself had been to me first an illicit dram, and then, as by a drunkard's reaction, nauseous. Even my recent attempt to live my philosophy had secretly, I now knew, been hedged round by all sorts of reservations. I had pretty well known that my ideal of virtue would never be allowed to lead me into anything intolerably painful. I would be reasonable. But now what had been an ideal became a command, and what might not be expected of one. Doubtless, by definition, God was reason itself, but would he also be reasonable in that other, more comfortable sense? Not the slightest assurance on that score was offered me. Do you remember the scene, the silver chair, when the girl's thirsty, she wants to drink, and Aslan's standing right there by the river. She sees Aslan and keeps asking him to take a step away. Will you just move back? And Aslan says, no. She says, do you eat little girls? And then he goes into all the different things he eats. In other words, there is no promise of reasonableness. There is no promise that he will not consume me and demand everything from me. Not the slightest assurance on that score was offered me. Total surrender. The absolute leap in the dark were demanded. The reality with which no treaty can be made was upon me. The demand was not even all or nothing. I think that stage had been passed. On the bus top, when I unbuckled my armor and the snowman started to melt, now the demand was simply all. You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted, even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility, which will accept a convert even on such terms. The prodigal son at least walked home on his own two feet. But who can duly adore that love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who is brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance of escape? The words compel and trar, compel them to come in, have been so abused by wicked men that we should shudder at them. But properly understood, they plumb the depth of the divine mercy. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men. And his compulsion is our liberation. He goes on to remind us all that he's not a Christian yet. He's just begun to believe in God. What happens next for Lewis, the final move, was a walk with J.R.R. Tolkien. He jokes about Tolkien, that Tolkien, he'd always learned that you should never trust Catholics and you should never trust philologists, and Tolkien was both. And he learned to, Tolkien was his dearest friends, one of his dearest friends. And on a walk with Tolkien, Tolkien says that basically drew a connection for Lewis that was remarkable. He said, the thing that most often awakened that desire in you was the study of myths, these ancient myths, myths that you recounted in music, myths that you, from Wagner, myths that you read. These myths awakened this in you. Does that not point to the fact that these are but shadows, glimmers, that point to a true myth, a true story, with a myth with a capital M? which is absolutely and completely true. And Lewis says that he left on that walk not a Christian. He came back from that walk having believed in Jesus absolutely. And so that was Lewis's conversion. That happened in, you can actually look at it right here, September 1931. So for 2 years, 1929 to 1931, he was a theist. He was attending chapel, but he wouldn't take communion. And then he became a Christian and began taking communion. And so that, those are the moves that Lewis took. And we have an hour left, and this is glorious. Or no, sorry, we have 30 minutes left. I scared some of you. It's going to be like an hour. I can take this for an hour. How about we do this? I could use about 3 minutes on my throat to get a little rest. How about we take about 5 minutes? You can use the bathrooms. You can get something to drink. And then we'll come back, and I want to kind of summarize these ideas and talk about what relevance they have for us. So bathrooms, drinks. All right. Let's finish it up. All right, what I want to do in these last 30 minutes, as least far as we can, we may come back to some of this tomorrow night if we don't get through all of it tonight, is I want to walk through just a couple of these core ideas and kind of pull them apart for you a little bit, read a couple more quotes, just let them kind of stand. And I point to these. I think these are ideas that have particularly impacted and shaped me. They've particularly impacted and shaped the kind of ministry we're trying to do at Park Church. I also think that they're particularly important for our culture right now. And I think they're central to Lewis's life. I want to pull these apart a little bit and just say, hey, here's at least at the very minimum, here's what Lewis has done for me and what I would hope he can do for you. First, I don't know of another author, writer, speaker ever, anywhere. I'm prone to overstatement sometimes. My mother-in-law just laughed out loud at me. I'll say this. John Piper said this, and he's not prone to overstatement, that there is no other, he knows of no other teacher, writer, author who connects the objectivity of truth. The truth is there. It is real. It is knowable. It is definable. It is not internal. It is outside of us. That the way that the universe is, it stands quite apart from what we think of it or not. That it stands, the connection between that reality and the pursuit of joy, and that those two things are absolutely linked. Absolutely linked. So that if you kill or diminish or confuse the objectivity of truth, that it's there. Quite apart from whether we start talking about exactly what it is, but it is there. There is a real doctrine of hell. By the way, just as an aside, Rob Bell wrote a book called Love Wins, right? Bad book. So he wrote a book called Love Wins. C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Great Divorce. And lots of people got really upset about Rob Bell's book, and then they said, and all you people who are upset, and then these other people said, you're all upset about Rob Bell's book. Why aren't you upset about C.S. Lewis's book? Because they seem to point to similar realities. They actually don't at all, but the difference between the two books, I actually had a lunch with a guy. This will illustrate this point. Lunch with a pastor, actually a pastor in our city. It was right around, it's like maybe eight months after Love Wins came out, and he wanted to get together to talk about it because he knew that we would have different takes on the book, and I wanted to sit down and have lunch. So we got together at Denver Ted's, which is proof that there's objective, real, knowable truth, and it's connected to joy. So we're sitting there, and the whole conversation was, he was wanting me to articulate the difference between Lewis on Great Divorce and Bell in Love Wins. And here's Lewis's objective in writing The Great Divorce was to make the doctrine of hell clearer, understandable. to take the concept, particularly the concept in Romans chapter 1, where hell is the wrath of God, where hell is defined as God handing people over to their sin. In other words, letting their sin or their insanity, which we'll get to that in a second, that actually has very much to do with this concept, letting that their insanity run its course forever and ever and ever. The point of people in hell being able to take a vacation up into the at least the front porch of heaven, but was not to say, was not his primary point there wasn't to say, hey, people in hell can make it to heaven. His point there was to say, look how terrifying this is. They're on the front porch of heaven, front porch of glory and beauty and goodness, and they hate it. This is what sin does. This is the corrupting power of sin. In other words, the point of Great Divorce was to, I was going to do all this tomorrow night, but was to clarify. It wasn't to muddy it. It wasn't to make it, wasn't to make you kind of scratch your head and go, oh, I don't know if the historic teaching on God's wrath and hell is true. It was to clarify, to spell it out in a way that was that could be quantifiable in the form of a story that you could see it and touch it. Love Wins, the whole point of the book was to muddy the water, was to make it less clear, to talk about how little it probably actually matters, how it actually make you feel guilty if you wanted to have a clear understanding of the doctrine of hell. And the lunch didn't culminate well, but with this pastor, with me saying, like, hey, the problem is that I understand my job as a pastor is I want to call you to joy, which my understanding, and this is Lewis, right? This is Lewis in the veins, the whole deal for me. Like, sorry if that was offensive. is my job then is to set a table and put food on it. And there's food on that table that you're going to hate. But God gives it to us to eat and says it's good for us. I hate steamed broccoli. But that's not my problem, right? Now, sometimes my wife says it's her problem. But like at the end of the day, like it's not a deficiency in broccoli that I don't like it. It's a deficiency in me. And that the whole point of pastoral ministry, actually I would say the whole point of the pursuit of joy is to find all of the things that God has given us to eat. The good stuff that we like, the big steaks that we call grace and mercy and beauty, all that stuff. And also the broccoli, like doctrine of hell or a biblical doctrine of sexuality or those kind of things, and learn how to eat those things as well. And the pursuit of joy is not just found in eating what we like, but learning to eat what we don't like, but that God has given us. And then he put his hands on the table and said, you're a thoroughgoing modern trying to do ministry in a postmodern city. I told him to go buy his own lunch. So, sorry. But the point here is that that if the pursuit of joy, the pursuit of satisfaction ultimately in God, if that's something that we should give some part of our life to, and I would argue that we should give our entire life to it, to finding that satisfaction, to finding joy and partaking of it, then that joy is only going to be found in an object, and that object is outside of us. It's not conditioned on our tastes or our particular likes or how this thing makes us feel. It is there, and the whole course of Christian discipleship, the whole course of, not just Christian discipleship, the whole course of learning to be human. And you see this play out for him in the Space Trilogy, particularly in Paralandra. I think one of the most terrifying figures in literature and movies I've ever seen in my life, I haven't seen it because then we made a movie out of it, it's Weston or, I think it's Weston. Is it Weston? Yeah, I get them mixed up between books. It is Weston in Paralandra. Because he's a man who's been so twisted, so unraveled by his refusal to align his life with what is objectively true and good and beautiful, that you see he is a no man. He is a not human. You see the unraveling effects of sin. It's the same thing you see in the Great Divorce. These people who have been in hell, who've made the journey to heaven for a short holiday, and they've become somehow less than what they are. They've, they're They're almost insane versions, magnified versions of our own sin, our own wickedness, our own selves. And so Lewis will say, hey, we are to pursue joy. And joy is going to have an object. That object is outside of us. It's not conditioned based on what we like or don't like. It is there. And the whole process of becoming more human, the whole process of Christian discipleship is learning to align ourselves with that objective truth. Learning to love what is truly beautiful. Learning to do that which is truly good and love doing that which is truly good. It's not a process of deciding for ourselves what is true. It's not a process of deciding for ourselves what our particular tastes are with regards to beauty or what our particular tastes are with regards to morality or ethics. His whole point, the whole project of his life is to say that they are there. Truth, beauty, and goodness stand outside of us, predefined, completely unreliant on us. And what Christianity offers us is a way through the gospel to slowly begin to align ourselves, to learn to love what is beautiful, to trust what is true, and to do that which is good. And that is the project of our lives, is to learn those things. Now, the spirit of our age is exactly the opposite of that. Ethics are determined by what you feel or like or desire. Truth is largely irrelevant in our day. Beauty is almost entirely a matter of taste. But what do you like? Lewis's whole point is he does not care what you like. Completely irrelevant to him. It is noise talking to the great knock on the way to the house. What matters is what is true. What matters is what is objectively beautiful. What matters is what is truly good. And what we must learn to do is conform our lives, align our lives with those realities instead of rebelling against them. And the reality that he plays out again and again and again in his fiction. The end of Till We Have Faces, I don't even know if I brought it down here, because if I brought it down here, I opened it, I would just start reading the whole book to you. But the end of Till We Have Faces, you see this woman's life come crashing down on the rocks of reality. The thing that she had denied her entire life turns out to be true. And that she finally admits that what she feared most is that it would be true. And Lewis puts himself in that character through that whole book. Oriol. Or I don't know how to say her name. Orwell. Or Yule. There's an O, an R, a U, an A, and an L. that's him. The thing he feared most turns out to be true. There is a God. There is a truth. There is a beauty. There is a goodness that we must reckon with. And it does not care what you think. Hear that rightly. It doesn't take on its particular properties or give moral laws based on your opinion. It simply and absolutely is that way. And so if that's true, and this is why I said, I think Lewis calls us into a kind of Christianity that's different than the Christianity he tried to articulate. Because if that's true, then us being as specific as we possibly can, getting as clear as we possibly can, about doctrines like substitutionary atonement or election or predestination or hell or gender or any of those things, any a myriad of doctrines, which a lot of churches would say, hey, that's just getting divisive and stepping into areas you don't need to step into. For us, it's not about tribes. It's not about forming the right club and making sure everybody's in the right club. It's about saying, I want God. I want every single bit of him I possibly can. Because that's joy. And I want you to come with me as we see him for who he is, as we hear what he says, as we learn to live under this reality that is simply and absolutely there. I want God. I remember they did, at Desiring God, they did a conference on actually did it on joy. Piper gave a biography of C.S. Lewis during that conference. And I remember sitting there and started, I don't even remember what was said. Sam Storms was speaking, and he quoted Lewis, and whatever he quoted from Lewis, it kind of sent my head racing, and then I started scribbling in my journal just over, I had like 5 or 6 pages just handwritten, scribbling furiously notes. And I couldn't read them right now to you because they're filled with curse words. but in it was just this newfound resolve to say, this is getting personal, sorry. I don't care if I offend you. I don't mean I don't care about you. This was resolve as a pastor. I don't care if you're upset when I have to say hard things from the scriptures. I remember distinctly writing, damn it, give me God. Give me all of him. Give me the hard edges I don't know what to do with. Give me the stuff that goes down smoothly. Give me the stuff that washes over me and feels like a blanket. And give me the stuff that is hard as ice and I don't know what to do in the face of it. But give me God. That's Lewis. I want joy. I don't want to feel good. I want joy. I don't want to be comfortable. I want joy. And if I'm to love you, and if you're to love your friends and your neighbors and your coworkers, then you would give them God. Don't give them the conception of God that they think they want. Don't give them the comfortable morality that they think they would like better. Frankly, truth is objective. Beauty is objective. Goodness is objective. It is there, and it does not care what you think about it. He reigns forever and ever and ever, and your life will either be spent, eternity will either be spent on your face, mesmerized by the beauty and the glory and the goodness you've been given in him, or you will gnash your teeth your whole life, angry that he is there at all. So that is the biggest, most important thing I've learned from Lewis. And you will get that. You will squeeze that from every page he writes. Whether he's writing about medieval literature, or he's writing about children who found a magical world, or he's writing about space beings on another planet, that is what he writes about. That's everywhere with him. Second thing that I've gotten from Lewis, and it's connected to this, there's a word that I use all the time with our staff and with our elders, and I get made fun of for it, and it's the word quiddity. I'm going to write it up here because it is my favorite word on the planet. It is a Latin term which simply means whatness. Clarified? What you get when you suddenly understand that connection between objective, real truth and joy is the freedom to just drink in the world, to enjoy the substance of a person, to enjoy the reality of not just that there are mountains, but the whatness of those mountains. This is an illustration that was Piper actually used. I found it really, really helpful. Imagine if you lived in a world where there was no such thing as water. And I came running up to you and said, you have got to see this. Dan's getting really mad when I do this. You're not going to believe this. I mean, you would fall out of your chair. Right? Never seen water before in your life. There it is, water. You'd be floored. You'd be just mind blown, right? Think about experiencing things that way. I mean, the ability to wake up in the morning and to this happened to me actually this afternoon. I was sitting at my desk and I just looked left, and there's I have a beautiful view of a graffitied garage door, an alleyway, and there's this beautiful little like that big out my window where you can see the sky, right? It's like that. And at about 4:15, it's just pink. Like mind-blowingly pink. Like pink, right? Like that pink, only pinker than that pink. It's not even pink compared to that. It's not even look at that. Like it's just amazingly pink, right? Like, wow! You can enjoy that. It's quiddity, it's whatness. I mean, imagine how many things we have that if we didn't have them, we would pay $1 million to have them. But having them, we ignore them. Like learning to taste and savor every single little thing. I mean, like you're sitting next to wonders right now. These people that have stories, that have weird little idiosyncrasies of things that they like and they don't like, and I mean, that's one of the most beautiful, amazing things that Lewis did for me about marriage. How amazingly, wonderfully strange and weird my wife is. And nobody else is allowed to call her weird. She don't know half of it. Her skin and her hair, like, she's turning red, so I'm gonna stop. But, like, the substance of life. I got a quote. Can I read a quote? A couple quotes. I don't care. Tell me no. Subjective, real truth. Doesn't care what you think. So, I got 9 minutes. So he talks about his two lifelong friends that he formed in college. One was a guy named Jenkins, another guy was a guy named Owen Barfield. Owen Barfield is a great dude. But the first paragraph about Jenkins, here's what he said. But Jenkins seemed to be able to enjoy everything, even ugliness. I learned from him that we should attempt a total surrender to whatever atmosphere was offering itself at the moment. In a squalid town, to seek out those very places where its squalor rose to grimness and almost grandeur. On a dismal day, to find the most dismal and dripping wood. On a windy day, to seek the windiest ridge. There was no Benjaminic irony about it, only a serious yet gleeful determination to rub one's nose in the very quiddity of each thing, to rejoice in its being so magnificently, whatever it was. A professor of mine from Wheaton, if you were here, were y'all around last fall? We did the symposium. He will be around. Or maybe you were. Dr. Jerry Root, and he is he's one of the foremost scholars in the world on C.S. Lewis, and I think he is C.S. Lewis incarnate. Just nerdy, wonderful. I mean, like, glasses that are, like, really thick, and his eyes are big, and he wears tweed jackets with pads and the whole deal. So he'd come in town, was doing this thing on evangelism for us, and then we went downtown. We were going to go eat at Euclid Hall. And so we had to park a few blocks away, and we're walking. You know that part of downtown where the stream is running, Cherry Creek is running through there? And we were walking, and we were having this conversation. He had a conversation with a girl that night who wasn't a Christian, who'd come to this thing, and he was all excited about. I mean, it was just, even the way he's describing this girl, it was like, man, he spent probably 7 minutes with her, and he saw more about her and her beauty and her story than I catch over years of relationships with people. The guy just sees people, sees everything. So we're walking, he's telling me a story, I'm getting all excited. And also, I felt a little bit like Lewis with the Great Knock, trying to explain things. And so we're walking along, and all of a sudden, he just stops. He goes, "Do you hear that?" What? In the middle of downtown. What are you talking about? And he says, "That sound, what is that?" And he looks and he runs over, like runs, this old man runs over, and he looks over, he says, there's a stream right here in the middle of downtown. It's like, yeah. Walked past it all the time. It's like, this is amazing. I want to come back here and see this during the daytime. He just goes on and on about the stream. And it was done. He started talking again about the girl. He kept walking. It's like this moment where he just taste and savored everything about life. This understanding that there is something outside of us, that the person sitting next to you is not And as soon as I say it, you're going to say, that sounds insane. But think about how we interact with people most of the time. That person sitting next to you is not primarily, they are not the culmination of the feelings and thoughts you have about them. They are someone outside of you. Those mountains are not just the tingly thing down your spine. They're there. It'll change the way you relate to people. Even if you're an introvert, it'll change the way you relate to people. You'll see wonders around you everywhere. Marvels in conversation. You'll never look at a sunrise the same way again. This is the world that Lewis opens up to us. I'm not going to have time to get to the next one, so I'm just going to read quotes for the rest of our time. I'm going to read one from Weight of Glory. I read Weight of Glory once a month. It's about 14 pages. You can read it in about 30 minutes. It'll change your life. So, here we go. I'm going to read about half of it to you right now. In speaking of this desire for our own far-off country, which we find in ourselves even now, I feel a certain shyness. I'm almost committing an indecency. I'm trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each one of you. The secret which hurts so much that you take your revenge on it by calling it names like nostalgia and romanticism and adolescence. The secret also which pierces with such sweetness that when, in very intimate conversation, the mention of it becomes imminent, we grow awkward and affect to laugh at ourselves. The secret we cannot hide and cannot tell, though we desire to do both. We cannot tell it because it is a desire for something that has never actually appeared in our experience. We cannot hide it because our experience is constantly suggesting it. And we betray ourselves like lovers at the mention of a name. Our commonest expedient is to call it beauty and behave as if that had settled the matter. Wordsworth's expedient was to identify it with certain moments in his own past. But all this is a cheat. If Wordsworth had gone back to those moments in the past, he would not have found the thing itself, but only the reminder of it. What he remembered would turn out to be itself a remembering. The books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them. It only came through them. And what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshippers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. Do you think I'm trying to weave a spell? Perhaps I am. But remember your fairy tales. Spells are used for breaking enchantments as well as for inducing them. And you and I have need of the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of worldliness, which has been laid upon us for nearly 100 years. Almost our whole education has been directed to silencing this shy, persistent inner voice. Almost all our modern philosophies have been devised to convince us that the good of man is to be found on this earth. I'll end with that. So thanks for coming tonight. Tomorrow night we will go back to Lewis, walk through his books. We'll pull out these themes in different places from his books. If you want to sit and talk about one particular book tomorrow night, I'd love, if you have a book you'd like to make sure we talk about, I'd love for you to talk to me now so I can make sure I've got, I stop where there's interest. So thanks for coming. Tomorrow night we'll continue to talk about Jack.